How the gentleman just asked what Irene was doing in Israel, please.
Yes, Irene had a long Zionist background as she started working for the Jewish Agency in London and worked there when Benbridge was in charge and when there was an effort to establish the Jewish state, and got to meet a lot of the leading figures back then. Once, because she was the low person on the totem pole, she took Martin Buber around and showed him London. That was interesting. And then she was not the first in her family to go to Israel. An uncle of ours, of course, had gone in the 30s. Her brother, a chemist, had gone a year earlier, Ailey. Then she went. In Israel, she studied, and she'll tell you herself about her very brief kibbutz experience, studied to be an X-ray technician, and followed that for the decade, which was interrupted once by a longer stay in England. She went back in for a while.
So she worked as a radiographer for what? As a vocation?
Yes, yes.
For 10 years?
Close to 10 years, yes. Lived both in Haifa and in Tel Aviv. And of course there are other relatives on my father-in-law's side who were there too. A physician, a woman who was a poet, another woman who was married to one of the chief justices of Israel. In that, you know, first of all, the state was very small, and secondly, with relatives and other relatives married into the family, you end up knowing virtually everybody. So she knew Golda Meir in a way that hardly anybody else does, through X-ray.
Oh, really? Did she come to the hospital? What hospital was it?
She'll give you the names of the hospitals, because I'm going to get them a bit wrong. But afterwards, for example, another relative who has just recently died is head of the atomic energy development in Israel. When she came here, she did not intend to. For a while she thought about doing something like X-ray, but saw that it was organized totally differently, and that this was really not the kind of thing that she wanted to do here. Didn't have the same, it was really a very minor function here, a much more major one in Israel. When she, after she settled in, And people did go out of their way to make us feel at home. There were lots of little parties at people's houses. Sisterhood president, Mrs. Marie Lassner, lots of others as well. And we found our own friends of our own age, and also, of course, the junior congregation, which was a very large and highly, it was in a sociable period. So there were lots of social functions. It was easy to make friends, to get settled in that way. Now, as far as being a rabbi's wife, Irene always went to services long before we met. In that sense, practiced Judaism. So she certainly did that. But she became active or involved, you might say, in junior congregation. Not interested in leadership positions or committee work. Went to the sisterhood. And when she was in doubt about something, she'd ask her mother-in-law, who, after all, had been a rabbi's wife for a lifetime. But really, a free author was always willing to be helpful, but very quickly learned that she was dealing with a totally different kind of a pregnancy. Because most of the rabbi's wives, whom she had dealt with before, were extremely young. Just out of college, we sort of led and guided. And that was not Irene's case.
Was that difficult for Mrs. Friedhoff, or?
I don't think so. No, I don't think she minded that at all. In fact, she probably enjoyed not having to push somebody through various stages. And the Friedhoffs were always very hospitable. When I was single, I think I mentioned that earlier, often had a meal over there subsequently, we always were over there at Thanksgiving time and other occasions.
Could you tell us a little bit about Dr. Friedhoff?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, one ought to talk more about the work experience of Rudolf Schoen than the marriage. My guess is that that would be more in line with what's happening here. When I returned in 1957, the building which I had seen under construction was finished. Now it was a matter of, there were the man who had succeeded me, Philip Gershon, left, and I became now the official assistant rabbi. So it was a matter of, first of all, learning the various arms of the congregation, everything else connected with it, because this is a reasonably complex structure here. And then helping Dr. Friedhoff with whatever needed to be done, setting up adult education to some extent independently, to a fair extent. Working with the junior congregation entirely independently, and being at least the titular head of the religious school. The religious school was very well administered by Stanley Levin. We quickly became good friends. It was a very large school, 1,400 children, and so there was a lot to be done. There were the usual issues of curriculum and style of education, which are perennial and certainly in the congregation of this size. People have different ideas of how a school should be run. And so very early, as, so to speak, in charge, I was to defend what existed and possibly suggest changes and deal with people who were happy or unhappy. Happy people usually don't bother to come. Unhappy people do. So that was interesting. The rabbinate here, the way in which Dr. Friedhoff arranged it, and the way in which I've arranged it for people who work with me, is that if you've got an area, you take care of it. And if you want to talk about something, talk about it. But as far as the normal details are concerned, it's yours.
So the religious school was yours? And Stanley Levin was the principal of the school.
Yes, and unless, you know, maybe once or twice a year, I would bring Dr. Friedhoff up to date on what was happening, or if there was an issue that was likely to arise, somebody might bring it up privately at a board meeting or something. I would make him aware of it. But otherwise, there was, we didn't talk about those kinds of things at all. And the same was true with represented at the Brotherhood and at the Junior Congregation. I would mention these things, whatever was happening to him. But that wasn't his style of rapping. As long as it was going smoothly, he really didn't want to be bothered very much with that. So we spent much more time talking about whatever he was working on, whether it was commentary or a speech or something with the World Union or the CCR or the Responsa. And sometimes pulled the volume off, studied. Can't really say studied together because that wasn't Dr. Field's style either. If he had a page of a Talmud that he was reading, he would not present it to you and say, read this. He would read it to you and show you the, you know, the intricacies rather than letting you puzzle it out and work it out. So we saw each other on a daily basis. Was in this office every day and I'm talking about something, but rarely about things that were the practical concerns of the day-to-day operation of the congregation.
And then did you start implementing going to people's homes and paying the doors called more than you had mentioned earlier?
No, I didn't, because that was really not what he wanted. He was interested in scholarly rabbinate and good sermons, good lectures. And of course, those were the days, which continued until about 5 years ago, of Sunday morning lecture sermons and Saturday morning the sermon. We instituted, well, not then, but a little later, early Friday evening service. But that was his emphasis, and speaking around the city. Not pastoral work. I mean, people would come to see him, and he would try to be helpful with them, but he did not encourage them. Felt much better if they came to see me. On him.
In the book reviews, did he start that?
Oh yes, he started that. He inherited a class which Dr. Goldenson had conducted, I think, in Browning or something like that, to which a handful of people came. And he decided that what was useful would be what he called a modern literature class, which really were book reviews. And very quickly, because of his great oratorical ability, this led to a huge attendance, and he made that the chief vehicle of his interfaith efforts. And that worked out extremely well for him and also for the congregation. Now, of course, in these years, the 50s, the late 50s and the 60s into the 70s, were years of major changes in American life. So the civil rights movement, all of that. He was interested, but didn't want to get involved in a more direct way. So left that pretty much to me, at least to organize. You know, if there was something big at the end of it, he wanted to be there and to present a Jewish point of view, but he did not want to be bothered with the things along the way. So that part led to a lot of involvement in the broader community, very early on.
Okay, Walter, unless you Excuse me, was it continue until that this is not, you know, that you haven't completed what you want to say? You and Rini are now married, and you're living in your bachelor apartment, and you moved into, and you have a child, a daughter?
Well, that was a little later.
Later, okay, I'm trying to, okay.
Yeah, a little later. By that time, we lived in another apartment, somewhat bigger. So that was, by that time, I was much more, I continued to work right from the beginning on my doctorate, and was fairly far along by the time we got married. More or less completed it. And also, the other change that occurred at that point was that we engaged a third rabbi. A friend of mine suggested him, Frederick Schwartz, and he and his wife moved up here. We'd always been friends at school. Both of us very different personalities. As different as you can get, but we got along extremely well, and I knew that that would work out for him. So then we had a child that was gone, and soon found out that she had severe difficulty. I guess it only took about a month to really discover. Diagnosed as a cerebral palsy, cataracts, possible retardation at the early stage, there was no way to tell. So we did whatever, you know, what we could at that point to stimulate her to move her along.
And what was her name?
Claire. She proceeded quite nicely for a while. I suppose that that's always so with kids like this, that the initial stages, the development is not too far off, but then after a while it doesn't completely stop, but it is greatly reduced. And so we did our best to move her along and to find whatever there was in the city to be helpful, which at that point wasn't very much.
Did you start her rising home?
Oh, that's a long time ago.
It is long.
Now, the first real help that we found by this time, Claire must have been, we called her Pucci, about three or four, was at the D.T. Watson home out in Sewickley. And they indicated that they wanted to work with people on a very steady basis. And so we left her there for the bulk of the week, and then picked her up every Friday and brought her back on Sunday. And that did help. And then, of course, she was home all summer. It was a matter of, you know, building a routine that would reinforce what they were trying to do. And that was a very, very good institution, an institution that has gone through a couple of changes. It began as a hospital for, I'm not sure it began before, but in the 40s it was a hospital for polio, and saw it in many of his experiments. When that was no longer a major issue, then they dealt with handicapped children, mainly cerebral palsy, but not entirely. And when that became less of an issue, more recently they have become a general rehabilitation center for that section of the city.
And then you have Tucson?
Yes. You know, all these things, I guess we can take the family and we'll take the congregation separately. I don't know how you can.
We have a question there, and I'm trying to just get some chronology of, you know, as we move along in your career, the parallel is your family development and growth, etc. So.
No, then we decided, because as we're cousins, there's a good likelihood that, though it's hard to know, that Claire's problem stemmed from that genetic problem, that we would not have any additional children that would adopt children. So we adopted Kenny in 1962 and Daniel in 1966. Both of them as infants. Daniel was in fact born prematurely, so he spent a fair amount of time in the hospital before he took an adoption. And that's worked out very well.
And they're married?
Kenny is married and has a little baby, Zach. Daniel is not married. And the children, you know, grew up as all rabbis' children, I guess, full of mischief. You have to try to see to it that they can live as normal a life out of the range of people as possible. And that played a role in our choosing a house which was not in the center of Squirrel Hill, so that we wouldn't have to deal with those kinds of issues, or at least be minimized. What can I say about kids growing up? They were fine. Did all the things that you normally do. Of course, always spending a lot of time with Claire and making her part of everything that one could.
And when did Claire die?
Died in 1974. Correct, yes.
Okay, we have your marriage. We're just going to go very, very skim through Irene's maiden name,
Lowenthal,
and her educational background and her career. She was a radiographer. Okay, setting up house, raising children. Early years, we know where you live, children's names, birth dates. We don't have to exactly do it, probably. You know about that?
Well, you can tell them.
No, they have to go on the tape.
All right, it's March 3rd, 1962, and June 4th, 1966.
Okay. And their educations?
They are both graduates of the University of Pittsburgh, both Taylor Alderdice High School.
Okay, now it's interesting because we're usually asking these of people who are not rabbis, but what was the custom, the religious custom within your home? Were you kosher? Did you conduct a reformed household? Your family customs, your traditions? It was just a little.
All right. We did not observe a strict kosher. Observed some things, like not mixing the milk, changing dishes for Pesach. Observed, of course, all the holidays, and Shabbat, with no work of any kind. And appropriate blessings before and after meals, these kinds of things.
So it's a Reformed?
Well, it was a Reformed household in a sense, but probably what a Reformed household should be.
And would you tell us that?
As I mentioned, taking Shabbat seriously, for example, not using it as a day of shopping at the lot.
Friday night?
Sure, but that's just the beginning of it. And conducting a little ceremony at the end of Shabbat to usher it out. Engaging in some study, seeing to it that there is some Jewish discussion around the dinner table, and thanking God for things that come along.
Okay, social life, you kind of mentioned that you've got some friends from the junior congregation.
Well, not only the junior congregation, other friends outside, too. You know, it's important. I'm going to get a drink of water.
Please do.
For some reason, it's going to be dry. Friends were partly junior congregation, of course, but also a good many from outside. Either people who ran into had common interests, or people Irene with whom Irene had some connection because of her Israel experience. And in any case, I think for most rabbis, maybe not. I'm sure for all, it's probably wise to have friends who are not in the Christian congregation.
And were they all Jewish, or did you have a mixture of different kinds of religions?
Here in Pittsburgh, most of the friends have been Jewish. Yeah, that's different from Springfield, Missouri.
Okay. But so the necessity, isn't it, in Springfield, Missouri, for somebody to say?
Yes.
The possibility?
Yeah, sure. And of course, colleagues too, one's closer, particularly here in Pittsburgh, I guess, Jay Evelson, Rabbi Evelson. Again, we're quite different in our interests, but have been close friends. And other rabbis that you work with, may or may not be quite as close.
And family vacations? Would you take family vacations? Or any traditional, consistently the same kinds of vacations? Or did you travel with the children?
Never took the same kinds of vacations.
Always different ones?
Yes. We both like to travel and travel with the kids. Dr. Treehoff, as you may remember, took long vacations in the summer. He went to Maine for virtually the whole summer, and then took a 3 or 4 week break in winter. So that set a pattern of longer vacations. As soon as it became possible, we did that with the kids, or even when they were very small, just toddlers. But we did that as camping vacations. Saw the eastern part of the country in that way, went west, clear across the country, up within a few miles of Alaska, all by car, with tents, seen as a different part of America, not only as far as countryside goes, and introducing the kids to that, but also seeing a totally different social group. It's too easy to become isolated. Square Hill, Shady Side, Point Breeze, wherever it is. And then the rest of the time, we did lots of things together as a family. So in the winter, starting, I guess when I was 1939 and took up skiing and did a lot of skiing with the kids. And with the children, that usually meant skiing leave because I couldn't go on weekends. And with Irene, that was possible during the week, just to take a day off every once in a while. And that was fine because there was nobody else on the slopes. Except a lot of school kids that didn't know how to ski. Yes, either, first of all, Boyce Park, which is a perfectly good place to learn, and then Hidden Valley, Seven Springs. Once we took a ski vacation in the winter and went to Maine. Well, it was 20 below zero. Not wind chill, just 20 below zero.
The wind chill was...
It was cold. And met my brother there, his children. That was very nice. And we also, through all the years, met my brother and I on Thanksgiving. Either here in Pittsburgh, or 1 year in Pittsburgh, 1 year in Evanston, where he was, or Madison, where he was earlier. And anyhow, kept close contact. We'd see each other a couple of times a year.